Welcome to session 5 of From Sad to Glad, How to Overcome Stress, Anxiety, and Depression and Feel Happy Again. I am Jonathan Robinson.
And I'm Emmett Miller.
I want to begin today by discussing how one's spiritual beliefs and practices can help a person in times of hardship. In my personal view, spirituality can be useful in terms of providing a person emotional support, as well as a sense of purpose and meaning. And spiritual practices can be incredibly helpful when dealing with challenges. But before we go into all of that, Dr. Miller and I are going to tell you a little bit about our personal spiritual backgrounds, as well as what we see as the goal or aim of spirituality. Emmett, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background that way?
Well, my family was Episcopal, so I grew up learning the things that a young Christian learns. But I had trouble really believing because I noticed that I had Jewish friends who learned something else and Catholic friends who learned something similar but different. So different that they were told in Catholic school if they so much as stepped their foot into a Methodist or a Lutheran church that this would constitute a sin on their soul that would help send them to purgatory or even to hell. Religions talked about love, but they had no compunctions in treating people in other religions very harshly, even to the point of attacking them and killing them. So I figured if the world could be so divided over the question that people really didn't know, so I became a militant agnostic. I couldn't even handle atheists because I thought atheists had more faith than anybody to think that all of this could just happen by accident. That requires an enormous amount of faith. So I continued as an agnostic, and when I got into medicine and when I began to develop my early tools for examining people's thoughts, teaching people to relax deeply, and helping people install new software in their minds and changing their lives, changing their health, and changing their habits, I began to realize that people who had something that they believed in were much more effective at being successful. So if you believed in Jesus and asked Jesus to help you stop smoking, then you had a good chance of stopping smoking much better than someone who had nothing that they believed in. On the other hand, if you believed in Moses or Shango, that would also help you stop smoking. And in so many cases, I could see this, that people who had a faith of some kind were able to tap into powers that were unavailable to those who didn't have that. So I began to believe in belief itself. And as a scientist, I knew that if all we knew of the world was what we could find, let's say, in Earth before there was life on it, we could know everything about the mineral world. We would never even dream about something as remarkable as life. The first plant cell that we saw would be absolutely amazing. There was no clue that such a thing could happen. And if you knew everything that there was to know about the plant world, you'd never suspect that something like an animal could exist. Who could predict a fox or an eagle? And if you looked at everything in the animal world, you would never begin to predict that something like the human being would come about and invent something like the Golden Gate Bridge or the computer. And likewise, if we look at all of humanity, there very well is probably another level, a level that cannot be easily seen simply by looking at what's here. And actually, it's far more likely that there is a higher level, even though we cannot describe it, even though we cannot see it. And I begin to realize that it's this level that people make up all these little stories about and imagine that there's a great man sitting in the clouds on a throne or a great female somewhere or something like that. And as I begin to believe that there's another level, that there's something greater than us, and that we have a purpose, a set of values in our lives, and we gain those values and that purpose by opening up to learn from that other level. I found that I've been able to make the same kinds of changes in my life to heal from my own depression and to find real happiness and fulfillment.
That's a nice story, and I appreciate your metaphors there, Emmett. My journey has been also rather long and varied. I was brought up as a Jew in a non-religious household and eventually became bar mitzvahed, but I felt like something was lacking, and I started on a search. As a teenager, I got into some drugs that made me wonder if there's something more going on. And eventually, this culminated in me having a experience with Jesus and Holy Spirit, in which I converted to Christianity. And although I had a problem with some of the dogma in Christianity, I found that I was just overwhelmed with the love and energy there, and was a rather devout Christian for a while. And then over time, I saw that there were principles of Buddhism that I found very useful in terms of practical strategies for tapping into a deeper level of peace. So I got interested in Buddhism and eventually entered a Buddhist monastery for a while. And then I saw that my job was really to explore all the different religions and find the stuff that seemed to work for me. Now, I know this is stepping on some people's toes and belief systems, but rather than thinking that there was just one way to a spiritual reality, I thought that there were many paths, and I really needed to explore to find which path and which practices seemed to resonate with me. So I got a little bit into Hinduism and Islam and different spiritual teachers throughout the world. In fact, I met a spiritual teacher who I've maintained an association with for about 25 years, whose emphasis has really been on becoming aware of what's in the way of deeper love and peace. He says that love and peace is our natural level of consciousness. It's really what we're made of, and that there's little things in the way, whether it be certain thoughts or certain habitual feelings or certain behaviors, and that our job is to become more aware of what those obstacles are so that we can let them go and come back to our natural, relaxed state of peace within. So that's been a focus of mine, and I've had some interesting experiences along the way. One of them I've talked about previously, where I interviewed a lot of spiritual leaders for a book called The Experience of God, and that's how I actually met Dr. Miller. And I also interviewed people like the late Mother Teresa and Dalai Lama, and people who are like very well-known Christian fundamentalists, such as Pat Boone, or scientists who have a very different take. And what was interesting to me about meeting and interviewing those people is that I asked them all 10 questions about spirituality, and they had a lot of variety in their answers. In fact, you know, if I asked somebody, how do you meditate, I might get a totally different answer from the Dalai Lama than I would Pat Boone. But there was one question in which everybody had very similar answers to, and the question was, what do you think is the purpose of human life? What are we here to do? And no matter what somebody's spiritual background, including a couple of atheists that were part of the book, I found that their answers were very similar, so I thought I'd share what that was, because that might be a good default purpose for you if you don't necessarily have a strong, passionate sense as to what your purpose is. There is, in my opinion, a purpose that is given to us, and a lot of these spiritual leaders agreed with that. So what they said was that our purpose is to become filled up from within with a greater love and peace. And in order to do that, you often have to do some kind of spiritual practice, or at least become aware of what keeps you from that love and peace within. And once you are filled up from within and you feel connected to a love and peace bigger than yourself, then you're in a really good position to help and serve other people. And so that has been a focus of mine. It's really a two-step process that happens simultaneously. One is become aware of what keeps me from that deeper love and peace and try to tune into it, either through Holy Spirit or through meditation or whatever practice I might be focusing on. And then when I feel that, to do my best to serve other people from my abundance, be able to help other people. So you might try that on and see what fits for you. I think when dealing with spirituality, it's a good idea to take what you can, what's useful for you, and leave the rest. You know, sometimes I used to have a lot of judgments about Christians that I didn't agree with their philosophies, such as that, you know, non-Christians are going to hell or whatever it was. And instead of rejecting all of what they said, I took what I thought was inspiring about who they were and what they did, and just let the other part go.
So you mean your karma ran over your dogma?
It has been said like that, yes.
What I've heard it said is that spirituality is to distinguish between the superficial and the essential. Mm-hmm. And to really go toward the essential, that everybody has what the Hindus call dharma, mm-hmm. your duty to the deepest part of yourself. And as you were saying, all the people that you talked to, somehow they all felt that there was something deeper, and that somehow that there was a duty to that deeper part of us. And to get in touch with it, and then somehow to express it in our lives and to share it with other people.
Mm-hmm. And as a psychotherapist, I started to see, as you did, Dr. Miller, that the people who had belief, who had a sense of purpose or spiritual understanding, were getting better a lot more quickly than my other clients. Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to go on their own spiritual search if they weren't on one, and for the ones who were on one, to deepen their practice so that they can be getting the benefits of their practices more deeply. Now, many years ago, I had a nice experience where I was invited to go to India to meet a famous guru, and he gave me a good lesson. So I travel all the way to India to meet this guy. His name was Punjaji, or some people called him Papaji. And I found my way to his ashram, which was not easy. You know, you take a long flight and the whole bit. And I finally entered his ashram, and the moment I entered, he pointed to me and he told me to sit in front of him. So I did, and I was a little nervous. I didn't know what the protocol was. There were about 50 people in the room. And I looked at him, and he had these shining eyes. And he looked at me and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Jonathan Robinson from the United States." And he and the other 50 people in the room started laughing hysterically. And I was all embarrassed, felt a little humiliated. And then I thought to myself, well, that was the wrong answer, you know. I didn't really know what was going on. So once I stopped laughing, he looked at me, he said, "No, I mean, who are you really?" And different answers came up. I thought, well, I'm an author, or I'm a man, or I'm a husband, or I'm a spiritual seeker even. And each time I gave him these answers, he said, "No, that's not it. That's not it. That's not it." I didn't know what was going to satisfy this guy. So at some point, I just looked in his eyes and I was silent, and he had these sparkling eyes. And there was a moment where I realized I was starting to feel love for this man, and that I could go towards that love and openness, or I could stay in my head and have a belief about him. He shouldn't have laughed at me, or whatever my thoughts were. And maybe I was worn down a little bit, so I went with the love. I decided to just relax and look in his eyes and see what was there. And it was a little bit like a wormhole. I just started to expand and expand, and I felt this overwhelming love. If you've ever just been inundated with love, maybe when you first met somebody or you feel totally safe, and I felt so much love from this man that I just started crying. And I started weeping, and then I thought it was funny. I don't even know why I'm weeping, so I started laughing, and I started laughing and crying, and soon everybody in the room was laughing and crying, and we were just basking in this overwhelming feeling of that there's something bigger than us that loves us. In this case, I tuned into that through the love of this man. And once I was done laughing and crying, and in fact, while I was laughing and crying, he kept on tapping me on my head, and he said a few magic words that I hold to this day. And he said, "This love is who you are, and don't you forget that." And I still remember that. And I, you know, we all get lost in problems and stuff, but I had the experience of knowing that we are made of a certain finer vibration that's beautiful, and we forget. So my job and your job is to remember how to get back there. And the spiritual journey is really the practice of remembering how to feel peace and how to be filled up from within. And it doesn't necessarily require a belief in God. Buddhists don't believe in God at all. And yet there are practices and beliefs that can help steer us towards that joyous, loving baby that we once were. So Dr. Miller and I are going to discuss various things, but I hope as you listen, that you listen for how can you overcome your obstacles and get back to that very innocent place where you're in touch with your loving heart, or you're in touch with a sense of peace that is always there beneath our mind's craziness and activity. You don't have to create peace. You don't have to create love. It's there. We just have to clean off the dust that has accumulated on the mirror of who we are.
Or at least that's a way that we can choose to believe. Mm-hmm. And what's so fascinating about life, when you ask a question like, you know, who am I? You know, what's my purpose in being here? As Shakespeare said, that man is the measure of all things. There's nothing either good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. So we don't ever really get the world inside of our head. We only have our ideas about it. And we're constantly writing a story about what's going on. You're sitting in front of this man. Who is he? He's laughing at me. Well, I'm going to show him, and I'm going to be resistant. That's one story. And another story is maybe he knows something I don't know. What if I let go of all the things that I thought were true, and what happens to me at that point? So we're always writing this story about ourselves. And when we write a story about ourselves where we believe that somehow deep in ourselves we are good, that the essence of who I am is good, the superficial is, that's the stresses from the outside world. It's the criticism, it's the judgment, it's the guilt, it's the blame, it's the shame, it's the lust, it's the greed, it's the envy, all of that stuff. That's not who I really am. Who I really am is that person that I feel myself to be when I'm with someone who really loves me, or when I'm with my pet, or when I was in my mother's arms or my grandmother's arms. I am good, I am kind, I am loving, I am fair, and I am here to share with other people who want to love and who want to do beautiful things, make beautiful music, have rich, rewarding relationships. That's who I am. Then our world becomes quite blessed when we begin to think of ourselves as being that positive person. So I suggest that people go deeply within themselves and let's think of all the negative things that you think about, just simply things that you've learned from the outside world. People have told you that you're no good because you're too tall, or you're the wrong race, or you're wrong color, or you're too fat, or you're too thin, or you're from the wrong side. All of those things that we learned as children when we didn't know that we had the choice to believe otherwise still linger as self-judgment and self-criticism. If we set all of that, and that's what meditation is about, that's what prayer is all about. When we set all of that aside, quiet that chatterbox inside the mind, it's like John Lennon says, what do you see when you turn off the lights? I don't know, but I know it's mine. I can't tell you, but I know it's mine. So go to that place. And so I encourage people to do that. And then just imagine that good self that you feel, that's who you really are. And when you begin to design your life around that as your center, then wonderful things happen. Well, for one thing, your stress is markedly reduced, your anxiety goes away, and there's no room for depression.
Mm-hmm. So when you have that view of the world, then the spiritual search is really a search for what helps you to get back to that center. Mm-hmm. And what helps you to let go of all the garbage that can get in the way.
Right.
Because I see spirituality as really a letting go process. You don't have to create peace and love. You have to let go of everything that's in the way. And that's really what the hero's journey is about. And I know, Emmett, you mm-hmm. are familiar with Joseph Campbell and that whole way of talking about things. And I know a little bit about it. But I wonder if you could say a little bit about the hero's journey.
Yeah. What I took from that, and I love Joseph Campbell's work and how he's taken all the different myths and stories from around the world and points out how they keep telling the same story, but with different characters and in different locations. And that what keeps coming up among that story is that story of the hero, like Odysseus, who's on a journey. And in that journey, you confront different challenges, and you have to find a way through those challenges if you're going to continue to go on. The one that strikes me is when Odysseus's men were going past the island where the sirens lived, and the sirens were these beautiful women who would sing these fantastically beautiful songs, and sailors could not resist steering their boats toward them. And of course, there were huge rocks around this island that would shatter their boats and kill them all. And Odysseus wanted to hear the songs, but he sure didn't want to steer his boats into the islands. So he had his men tie him to the mast and plug up their ears with tar. And he said, no matter how much I beg, do not untie me, but keep a straight course. And so, of course, as they go past the island, he hears the song, and he begs and pleads, please let me go. But, of course, his men won't let him go, so he manages actually to hear the song, but to still live. And this is what the hero is able to do. They're able to come into contact with things in the world that usually will destroy you, but somehow the hero is able to go on by dint of some guidance or power.
Mm-hmm. So he manages to get the enjoyment of the world without getting too lost in it.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right.
Right. And that's really our journey, is that, you know, people listening to this are probably having some struggle with, stress or anxiety or depression. And I see that our mission, our job, our purpose is to be on the hero's journey, to learn how to overcome those obstacles and get back to a happy, peaceful, deep place within ourselves. And everybody has their own unique curriculum. One person's curriculum is not better than another's. So whatever is happening in your life right now, that is the perfect part of the hero's journey to be on, the perfect curriculum for you to hopefully overcome those obstacles and get back to a place that feels good. And so that can be your default meaning and purpose. You may not have a bigger spiritual purpose, but you're given the curriculum of your life to see if you can overcome those challenges. And by overcoming those challenges, you become a stronger person. You know, people sometimes ask me how I became an author and got to reach a lot of people and find the peace. And I say, well, you know, one of the things that really helped was that my stepfather used to occasionally beat me. And I'm very grateful to him, because if it weren't for the fact that I had a rather difficult relationship with him, I probably would not have gotten into this stuff. I probably would have just went for a nice, comfortable, superficial life. And you probably have a similar story.
Yeah. Well, like Friedrich Nietzsche said, that what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Mm-hmm. And you talk about it as a curriculum. And so what if we were to think that we're really in a kind of a school, sort of university U, and each of the things that happened to us is an opportunity to learn a lesson. I understand that some Buddhist groups believe that after death, before you're reincarnated, you decide what lesson it is you want to learn in your next course. And so you choose a life in which you will be confronted again and again with certain specific kinds of obstacles. And to overcome those obstacles, you need to begin to see them as challenges. Begin to say, oh, this is a challenge, and I like a challenge. And in fact, that challenge is an opportunity. And so as each thing happens, the question is, what am I to learn from this? What's the deeper meaning of this? There's a positive meaning to this. There's always that voice that's going to say, well, the meaning to this is you're just not good enough. But no, that's not what the meaning. There's another meaning that's deeper. And that's what the hero is doing, looking and finding that deeper meaning, that deeper purpose for their being there, and then learning what you need to learn from the situation. And then you can go on, and then you don't have to take that class again.
Yeah. Well said. You know, before we go into talking about spiritual practices and how you can make use of these points of view, I want to mention an experience I had many years ago, about 22 years ago now, that taught me a lot and put this in a different context. I was driving to the airport. I was a passenger in a van, and the guy was going very fast and hit a patch of ice, and we went off an embankment, and the van rolled a few times, and several of the people in the van were thrown out of the van. One ultimately died. And I was knocked so hard that I stopped breathing. And just by a strange coincidence, there was a fire truck that saw all this and got to us rather quickly. And the fireman saw that I wasn't breathing and did what he could to bring me back to life. So I had what has sometimes been called a near-death experience, and it is definitely a life-transforming experience, although you may have heard of such an experience where people see a light and they go through a tunnel and they often have a life review. The experience is very intense, obviously. And I had that experience, but during the experience, something interesting happened. And what was interesting is that I felt like I was being asked to look at my life through the lens of two questions. This was not something I expected. I had read that people sometimes see a light and such, but I didn't expect that my life review would be filtered through two questions. And I will, in a little bit, tell you what those questions are so that you can, in a way, cheat on the final exam of life, because I do think of it as kind of the final exam. Later, when I recovered from this, I found out that people who remember their near-death experiences often feel like they are asked the same two questions. And it really doesn't matter what religion a person is from or what culture they're from. They often have the sense that they are asked the exact same questions. So the question that first came to mind as I was dying and having this life review was the question, what have you learned about being a loving person? What have you learned about love? And I think it's no coincidence that most religions have as their central core component either compassion or love. That's part of what we're here to do and to learn about. And up to that point, I saw that in my life review, there hadn't been much of a focus on love, more of romantic love, but that really wasn't what this question was about. The second question a little bit surprised me because it wasn't what I expected, and it's hard to translate it into English, but I'll do my best. I would best put it as, what or how well have you completed what you came here to do? And in that question was the sense that we're here to do something. We're here to do what's most important to us. Now, if what's most important to you is to have a lot of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, then you should be doing it fully. If what's most important to you is to pursue God, then you should be doing that fully. So the question was really, how well have you been you and pursued you to the fullest? Being that that was really my curriculum, that was what I was given life for. And once again, I didn't get that high a grade at the time for that, but it inspired me that, you know, life is short and it's time to really do the things that you consider most important to you, to become the person you want to be. And so that experience was very instrumental for me. And it's interesting to me that whether a person comes from Papua New Guinea or Dallas, Texas, or Scandinavian countries, that when having a near-death experience, the experiences seem to be very similar. So I think that these questions are really part of our life and should be part of how we approach life. Questions about how well are we really going for it? How well are we being loving and trying to be filled up with love so we can be a more loving presence in the world? So yeah. That's a little bit of what I wanted to share.
Yeah, that love, it does seem to be a factor that comes up. And to me, I see love as a very profound, primordial power or energy that tends to draw things together and to make wholes, to make complete things. I believe if we look at the atomic level of things, we see that we have ionic bonding, in which you have fires and explosions and so forth, but to have life, you need carbon bonding. And carbon bonding involves sharing electrons rather than taking electrons from someone else. And because they share electrons, they stay together, and therefore you can form proteins and DNA, and therefore you can have life. And what holds a single cell together is that same force of wanting to hold together. It holds together the cells of a multicellular animal, and it holds you and me together. Our bodies and all the parts of us are functioning to create wholeness, and that's a form of the love. And what holds a mother to the child, and that is a form that that same force. There's a woman is willing to, in a moment's notice, to die to save that child's life. That's love. That's the holding together. Or if we see a community that holds together in that way. So that love is somehow a force of wholeness and coming together. And for me, it's exactly the same as the life force, because without it, there could be no life. And it's the same thing as healing, because healing is about becoming more whole. And that is what we usually find ourselves talking about. So in whatever language a person uses, whatever the stories are, there is, as we go deeper, the wanting to hold together, to be close, and to experience love in one way or another. And as you say, that a person may say, oh no, what I'm here is to drink and smoke and party, and that's my purpose. Well, you know, if you give me a few beers, then I might really feel that that's the most important thing. At least I will tonight. Tomorrow morning, I may feel differently. Mm-hmm. Or someone might make me very angry, and I just want to punch their lights out. And that might seem like what I really want to do at that moment, but that's not really what I want to do. And so I think that it, when we say that, it's about, yeah, finding out what you want to do, but being honest with yourself and not just saying, oh, because what you don't really want to do is to be under the influence of a drug, whether it's an external drug or it's an internal drug of your own neurochemicals. You don't want to be under a temporary influence. You don't want to be going for the superficial. And so if we're looking for what's more essential, do that. See what the experience is, and you usually go deeper and discover more about who you are. And a near-death experience certainly is a wonderful way to begin to get in touch.
Although I don't recommend it. So don't drive your car off a cliff.
Right. Jonathan told me to do it.
But, you know, what Dr. Miller is saying is clarification. To be fully you doesn't mean going for superficial pleasures. It means going for the essence of what is really important to you. And when people think in those terms, even if they go through a period of sex, drugs, rock and roll, nothing wrong with that, that they find that certain things in life don't give them the deeper satisfaction that they were really looking for, and then they start looking for that. And I know for me, I went through a period of years where I tried a lot of things, you know, and saw that a lot of them didn't give me what I want, which led to a deeper search of finding what is behind that, what's deeper than that. So this is hopefully a helpful theory and sermon, but really the question now is, how can you make use of this to help you with whatever challenges you face? And Dr. Miller and I have some exercises, and we want to talk about some spiritual practices that I think will be very useful for you. Now, one practice which I have found very useful, and I've given it out to a lot of people, I call it writing down your ideal obituary. And what the purpose of this exercise is to get a sense of what is really important to you. Because if you have that sense, you can go back to it, and it can be like a compass that sets you straight when you have lost your way. Now, I got this idea actually from a story I had read in a book about a man in the 19th century named Alfred. And this is a true story. One day this man, a wealthy man, was reading the obituary part of his local newspaper, and he came upon his own obituary. This is not an experience many people have, obviously. It ends up that his brother had died and they had mistaken the body, so he's reading what he's known for in the paper. And what it says is that he was very wealthy and that he had made his money through the killing and maiming of tens of thousands of people, and he was known throughout his country as the Merchant of Death. Now, this is a true story, and he obviously was not very happy with that obituary. So this man, Alfred, asked himself a good question. The question was, what would I like to be known for by the time I really die? And he thought about this question. And since he had a fair amount of wealth, he thought in big terms. He said, well, if I could be known for anything, I'd like to be known for you know, great achievements in the areas of science or literature, or even being known for an achievement in the area of world peace. So this man, Alfred, last named Nobel, started the Nobel Prizes. And by the time he died many years later, he was known as the most impactful humanitarian of the 19th century. So he went from being a guy known as the Merchant of Death to somebody who inspires us even today, over 100 years later, as somebody who is helping humanity learn and grow in artistic and other ways. So it's never too late to find out who you want to be. And writing down your ideal obituary is a simple way of doing that. In one of the handouts to this week's session, I give an example, a personal example for me about my ideal obituary. And as you can see, you can make it rather lofty. You can think big. What do you want your friends to say about you at your funeral? What do you want your partner or your kids to say about you? What do you want to be your contribution? Make it as big and as flowery as you want, because it's really for you as a way of saying, this is who I want to be. Do you want to be known for somebody who makes a lot of money, or do you want to be known as a loving, kind person? Do you want to be known as somebody who's there for their friends? Make it as specific and as grandiose as you want, so that it inspires you every time you read it. I encourage you to put it on your computer so you can periodically come back to it and read it. And for me, I have found it very useful in terms of making major life decisions. You know, I have to decide, do I want to go to this workshop? Well, is that going to help me become the person I want to be? You know, I have to decide, do I want to take on this project? Well, what's my ideal obituary say? Because if it does not lead me in that direction, then maybe it's not a good idea. So that's how I've used the ideal obituary, and I've given it to a lot of people, and they have found it to be very helpful in staying true to their path. I personally read mine about once a month. Sometimes I alter it a little bit, and it has been a very useful experience for me. Have you ever done anything like that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, because and as you know, so much of my work has to do with working with imagery, and imagery is all about creating the image of where you want to go. And so if you're working with deep relaxation, you visualize yourself winning the race, then you have far more likely chance, you're far more likely to win the race than if you didn't use that imagery. So what's always happening is that the nervous system and the mind is always striving to reach what it thinks is the outcome that you want to reach. If you're hammering something and you hit your finger with a hammer and you say, oh, you idiot, the brain sort of figures, oh, I guess you must like that. You got really excited about that. Well, let's see what we can do to make you more of an idiot. You know, if you hit your finger with a hammer and you feel the pain in the finger and you stop for a moment and say, this pain may have a purpose in my life. Right now, what is it that I need to stop and pay attention to? Well, you know, maybe I really shouldn't be hammering right now. Maybe I should be upstairs studying for the test tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So when you think about what your ideal obituary is, it's like a skier visualizing himself ski the slalom and mm-hmm. cross the finish line. And your obituary is kind of you crossing the finish line. And it gives you a chance, as you say, to be very grandiose about it. Because if you want to learn how to play the violin, and so you want to listen to some masters play the violin, you want to listen to the best violinist you can, because you want your system to work toward that goal. It doesn't make any difference whether you ever actually get there, but A man's reach must always be greater than his grasp, or else what's a heaven for, as they say. So you're setting that vision out there, and that determines your direction. So it's not about getting there, and that's the important thing.
I like to say that being on the right road, going slowly, feels infinitely better than being on the wrong road going fast.
Right. We're on the wrong road, but we're making such good time.
Yes, yes.
Yes. So
and most people don't really have a clear sense. They've never written it down who they want to be or what they want to contribute. So by making it, as you say, graphic or having good imagery to it, it kind of has a magnetic pull where it can pull you towards it more easily than if you have no image. And the culture and your parents and your friends are always providing their ideas of, quote, success. You know, in this culture, success is often defined as having a lot of money. But most people wouldn't say, what I really want people to say about me at my funeral is that I had a lot of money. You know, or I watched a lot of TV. Mm-hmm, you know, we generally want to hear people say how loving or how helpful or other inspiring terms. So we should flesh that out in terms of making specific images or ideas that we can read over and over again, so we have a clear sense of what we want.
And even if you don't have any idea how to get there, it's still, that's the time maybe when it's most important, maybe when all you can do is watch television and make money, that you ought to stop and say, what would I like to see if I got to read my own obituary?
Yeah, yeah.
And what's yours currently?
Well, mine had to do with that I was a daring spiritual explorer, always open to learning new methods of helping myself and other people reach higher levels of consciousness. And by learning those things, inspiring millions of people to do practices that help them to get in touch with the peace and love within.
And you even as you say it, you know, you visualize it inside. And as you visualize it, and something inside goes, yeah, that would really be, and something you feel inspired just by thinking that way. And sometimes I think about, like, every cell in your body has like a compass in it, like a little compass you might have when you go off hiking. And that when you hold a clear vision in your mind, all of the little compasses point in the same direction. And so you're really aligning the cells of your body, the cells of your nervous system. You're aligning your thoughts, you're aligning your emotions, you're aligning your gifts and your talents in going in that direction. And after doing something like that, you'll tend to have a different day just because you stop to think about it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I originally wrote my ideal obituary after coming back from this auto accident. And at the time, I had no money. I was living in my van. And somehow over time, you know, one thing led to another, and the books and Oprah and all those things. And now I've affected millions of people indirectly. And just as important to me as that is my life has been healed. I'm not experiencing the stress, anxiety, depression I did as a teenager and young adult. So when you're aligned with your deeper purpose, good things tend to happen. So what we want to do from here is have Dr. Miller and I talk about various spiritual practices that you might want to explore. And as we talk about them, you probably have heard of most of these, but the question is, are you attracted to them? The ones that you haven't practiced, might they be something that you want to try out? Or the ones that you have tried, may you want to recommit to a deeper practice? Because it's really only through daily practices that one deepens their connection to the peace and love within. You know, a nice belief is a fun thing, but beliefs cannot get you to a higher level. They're just beliefs. At least that's my belief. So we're going to briefly talk about various spiritual practices and talk about how we have used them or what we like about them. And as we talk about these, if you find that one of them calls out to you, that might be a sign that this is something for you to focus on.
So it might be a good idea to just take a moment now before we go on to look at these other possibilities. Become aware of what your personal values are. Just let your body relax. Take a couple of deep cleansing breaths. Close your eyes if you're in a place where you can do that. Think, relax. Let your mind be clear. And go to the deepest place within yourself that you know how to get to. It could be a meditative place if you're a meditator, or it's a place that you go when you pray. Or just a safe place, a sacred place that you can visualize in your mind. To that place where you can be as much as you can in touch with the deepest aspects of yourself, the most essential. Let go of the outside world. What's really important to you? What are the things that you value most in life? At the deepest level you can reach, who are you? What kind of thing would you like to see in your obituary? How would you like to be remembered? Do you have a sense that you have a purpose or mission here, that your life is not meaningless? What's your sense of what that purpose is? Do you feel the duty to the deepest part of yourself? Just to be aware of it. Nothing else that you have to do. And you don't know how you're going to do it necessarily. That's okay. What is of most value to you? And breathe into that part of you. Into that deepest part of you. Breathe into your own purpose, your own mission.
So from this relaxed place, you may find it a good time to write your ideal obituary, or at least refer to the handout so that you have an idea of what type of thing you want to put in that. And as we promised, we want to go over other spiritual practices that Dr. Miller and I have found useful and talk about them for a minute as to what we see their purposes and how they have been useful to us and how they might be useful to you as well. Now, we've already talked about meditation a fair amount, so I think I have very little to say about it other than the power meditations that you got as part of this program can all be useful guided meditations. And of course, you can learn meditation techniques on your own to meditate whenever you want. So I see meditation as anything that helps you to quiet your mind and open your heart. And there's many methods for doing that. And of course, as we've mentioned, they all can help you to overcome stress, anxiety, and depression and be of great value.
A colleague of mine had asked a young girl what she thought the difference between prayer and meditation were. And she said, well, prayer is when you're asking God for something, and meditation is when you're listening to hear what God has to say.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice metaphor. You know, as being a psychotherapist, I have been very impressed with people who have taken on the 12-step programs, the most common one being Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's now over 50 anonymous type programs in America and millions of people in these programs. And a lot of people who have not been in those programs may not realize that these programs are spiritually based. The first step is that we saw that our life was unworkable and we decided to surrender our life and our problems to a power bigger than ourselves. Sometimes it's worded differently, obviously. But if you have some kind of addiction, even addiction to stress or anxiety or depression or certain types of relationships or drugs or alcohol or certain behaviors that don't serve you, I think being part of an anonymous type group like AA can be a wonderful spiritual path, and the 12 steps are a step-by-step program for spiritual maturity.
And they're based on the 12 steps that Carl Jung had developed.
Yeah, Carl Jung was a very famous psychologist, and he saw what seemed to be what worked cross-culturally in terms of spiritual development. And that was part of how these 12 steps got created. And you can go find a meeting near you. They're all free. And see if it resonates with you if you haven't experienced such a thing. I definitely encourage that.
Or you can just get a copy of what's called the Big Book, and that'll give you a lot of guidance.
Yeah, they go into the 12 steps there and give you an overview of the path. And it resonates for a lot of people, and I have seen and been impressed with its effects on people's lives. So another spiritual practice that we both can recommend are can be grouped under the category of yoga. There's many different yogas, but in America at least, the most common form of yoga involves hatha yoga, which are bodily positions to experience more of a sense of ease with your body. And if your body feels more at ease, then probably your mind and emotions do as well.
A lot of people may not know much about yoga. I know when I grew up, the only yoga I knew of was Yogi Berra.
I don't think that counts.
That doesn't count, no. But yoga is a Sanskrit word, comes from the same as the root for yoke, like you yoke two oxen together. And it has to do with coming together and becoming one. And the notion behind it is that by practicing diligently at whatever is your path, then you can become one with God, one with all that is. And so you have hatha yoga, which is the yoga of the body and has to do with being in these different postures. There's tantric yoga, which has to do with using sexuality as a way toward oneness. There's bhakti yoga, in which you serve. You simply serve whoever and whenever you possibly can. There's karma yoga, where you simply work. There's a yoga of thought and contemplation. There's a yoga of passion and energy. And whatever is the right yoga for you, that's the one that enables you to do your dharma. And there's an old saying, which is, to do your own dharma poorly is 1,000 times better than to do someone else's dharma well. In other words, find out what is your path and go toward it.
Mm-hmm. As Dr. Miller said, one form of yoga has to do with kindness or service. And in session 4, we talked about how when you get out of yourself and you're kind, you tend to become much happier. And I mentioned the question previously, what act of kindness can I do today for a stranger or friend? That question is the single most powerful method they found for quickly increasing a person's level of happiness. But some people I know really are of service all the time, and therefore they're much loved, and they manage to get out of their own small self and experience a certain peace and higher level just from doing that. Now, One method, which we've all heard of, is prayer. And it's not specific to the Christian religion. All religions have some form of prayer in it. And I once heard prayer described as a conversation you have between you and God. And I liked that description. You know, imagine that God was your friend, your best friend, and you're asking for help or getting guidance, and you're talking to God from your heart. Now, I am not an expert in prayer. I occasionally do it. So there's not much I can say about it other than when I do it, I try to imagine that I'm just speaking from my heart to a being that loves me. And for those of you who have done prayer and taken it farther, I would say do it more often. See if it can really be your compass, your internal compass, to getting back to a good place, a centering place within you. Anything you want to add to the power of prayer? Okay, well, then we'll go on to the next thing. Though I have been pretty impressed with the studies that show that people who pray and get prayed for seem to heal quicker from sickness. And that's something that can be scientifically validated. So all of these forms of spiritual practice have real world effects in terms of helping people to feel better. Mm-hmm. Another thing which I have explored quite a bit is what is commonly called mindfulness nowadays. Mindfulness is being very aware of what you're thinking and feeling and doing in the present. So you could call it developing presence. And there's a lot of methods for doing this. If you're interested, you could Google mindfulness and you'll get a lot of information. There's been some studies showing that mindfulness practice and teachings can help people overcome depression. A man named Jon Kabat-Zinn has written some books about this and has very well scientifically documented this method as a way of helping people through difficult challenges. So mindfulness meditation, where you become aware of your thoughts, you become aware of your behavior as it's happening, and often what they do is they use methods like labeling, like I'm having a negative thought, or I'm having a neutral thought, or my right knee feels warm. Very much in the present moment. I know when I deal with difficult emotions, sometimes I'll just tune into the feeling and ask myself, what does it feel like on a sensation level right now? How big is it? What warmth or coolness is there? Is it throbbing? Is it staying the same size? Is it moving? And by focusing on exactly what's happening in this moment, you can often get to a deeper level of peace, and things that used to bother you just kind of slide off you like Teflon.
Yeah, another way to do it is what Roberta Saggioli used to say, I have that feeling, but I am not that feeling. So mm-hmm. I may say, right now, I have the feeling of anger, but I am not anger. I am love. Mm-hmm. And you just sit with that. So by simply being able to see the world, to realize the cause of all suffering is wanting things to be different from how they are, to simply accept that it's there. It could be a pain. It could be a dysfunction of some kind, which is not comfortable. But if you can simply view it, this is what I'm experiencing in this moment, and that's okay. If you can accept it, then your system stops fighting against it, and then the suffering goes away. Mm-hmm. So we will have pain. Everybody will have pain in their life, but the suffering is optional.
Yeah, it's our resistance to events that usually causes the suffering. Mm-hmm. And something that I personally found helpful is something called the Sedona Method, which I've talked about before, and is part of your power meditations. In fact, I believe it's number 6, 10, and 11 on the power meditations are examples of guided Sedona method meditations. And the essence of what is there is you focus on exactly what is happening and you welcome it. And then by welcoming it fully and experiencing it fully, you're in a better position where you can just let it go and release it. So it's really the art of releasing and letting go of the obstacles that we tend to adhere to. So mindfulness or Sedona method are very similar methods for reaching a deeper level of peace. I want to briefly mention another method that's very popular, and that is reading from holy books, whether it be the Bible or the Torah or the Quran or your favorite holy book. We need inspiration from people and systems that have talked about the purpose of life in a deeper way. You know, we live in a rather superficial culture. So by reading from holy books, it can help bring us back to what is essential and important and can help motivate us as well to do other spiritual practices. I know people who read, you know, 10 minutes a day, an hour a day, and find that that spiritual practice of reading deeper words really helps them get in touch with their own depth. You know, one of the most popular methods, spiritual practices around the world, although it's not that popular in America, is chanting. But I think America has its own form of chanting. I would call it singing worshipful songs. When I was very focused on Christianity, I really loved just singing songs of worship to God, and it was very moving. I could feel connected to everybody in the church. I felt a great love within myself. And when you sing such songs, whether it be singing or chanting, it's really hard to get lost in your problems at the same time. It kind of takes you away and takes you out to something bigger than yourself. So if you find that you like singing or if you like chanting, you may figure out a way of doing that on a more regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing about the singing is it entrains the mind. And when you're singing a tune, there's a coherence and a rhythm and the balance within the song and the music that you're singing. And so you're bringing rhythm and balance and integrity to your mind, and immediately you begin to feel better. It's hard to feel bad when you're singing, hard to feel sad and depressed if you're singing a song. So finding a song to sing is a good idea. And I would add dancing. Of course, I think the Sufi dancing, the whirling dervishes that we've seen, is perhaps a perfect example of that. But there are many forms of trance dancing. In fact, sometimes when you're kind of feeling down, put on music that you really like that makes you feel turned on, or, you know, whatever, flash dance or What a Feeling or There's a Hero or whatever it is that makes you move, and dance with it for 3 minutes and see if you don't feel somewhat better. So and if you make that into a spiritual thing, because many songs have very spiritual words to it, so, and music does. And so if you're dancing to something that has spiritually inspiring words, that's a wonderful way of prayer.
You know, before this session, we were talking about different spiritual disciplines, and I didn't mention dance because I am a very poor dancer, so it's not a spiritual experience for me. It's more of an embarrassing experience. And Emmett was saying, no, dance is, you know, very much can be a spiritual experience. And I know it is for my wife. In fact, that's one of her prime spiritual practices, is to dance every day. So just because something doesn't work for you doesn't mean it doesn't work for somebody else. And you really have to give each of these methods a try and see which one resonates. And that's the best way to know what is worth pursuing.
Because you want to find what your path is. It's mm-hmm. not about judging paths. It's about finding the one that works for you.
Right. And Tai Chi or Qigong are forms of movement meditations that I thought were kind of ridiculous until I spent a month in China around Tai Chi and Qigong masters and realized that they had really tuned into something amazing. I took it on as an experiment because I didn't really know anything about these forms of spirituality. They're very much about opening up to the internal energy within you. And I had my judgments, but after spending a month in China, I say, wow, that was really something. And it's now part of my daily spiritual practice. So we're at a place where we're going to begin wrapping up with what we've talked about. What's most important for you to get from this is that the key to moving forward in life, even through challenges, is to find practices that work for you and do them until you can tune into the peace or joy or love that they can potentially bring on a more regular basis. So my assignment to you is that of the many practices that we talked about in today's session, that you choose one or more to practice and explore over the upcoming week or however long you take before you go on to the next session. Now, one handout which I have here in your session 5 packet is 25 things that can help you with your spiritual exploration. This was part of a book I wrote called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Awakening Your Spirituality, you know, those orange books that were popular. And I came up with 25 things that I find are helpful, and you can read that. But if you need to sum it down to one thing, I'd say find a practice that works for you, do it for as much time as you're willing to do it, and if a practice is really hard and difficult, you might try another practice because it's unlikely that you're going to keep on doing a practice that you don't like. So that's my message, and I'll let Dr. Miller close us out with his parting words.
Okay. Well, let's maybe just a little bit of an experience to use the power of your mind right now. Remember that your thoughts are behaviors, your emotions are behaviors, and your beliefs are behaviors. And if you want to change any of them, you have the power to do that. So, well, let's imagine that that's true for a moment. And imagine that, in fact, you have a deep purpose, that there is a spiritual center within you. Imagine that you are at the deepest place, love. And imagine that right now you're right where you're supposed to be, that you're exactly the person that you're supposed to be, that nothing's extra and nothing's missing, that you have a deep purpose, and that what you really want is available right now. And that by letting go of what you don't need to take with you, you can see who you are and know what it is that you're to do now. Imagine that somehow your purpose is to love, to give love, and to serve, and that there's a way, if you are willing, to bring yourself into harmony with that. Your mind belongs to you. And just imagine that you have the ability to discover your purpose and to discover your path. If you already know what that is, imagine yourself following that path. If you don't know, imagine that by exploring some of the possibilities that we're offering you, that you will find it. And imagine yourself following it and becoming the person that you really want to be. And we'll see you soon for session 6.
Have a great week, and we look forward to our final exploration when you're ready. Thanks.